Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck On Demand. I'm John Schaefer. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In a little while, no music left behind. We look at attempts to bring musicians into New York City public schools and ask just how effective they really are. And then later, a new take on some old Jewish music. But to begin today, it's the eve of World AIDS Day, and many are turning to the music of Afrobeat giant and political activist, the Nigerian pop sensation Fela Kuti. His music has found its way around the world. In 2002, it was the inspiration for a widely acclaimed record called Red Hot and Riot, devoted to raising awareness about AIDS and HIV in Africa. But Fela's music is also heard regularly right here in New York. And we are joined today by Paul Heck, the co-producer of the record Red Hot and Riot, and by the producer and DJ Rich Medina. Rich, let me start with you. You produce a regular party here in New York, the Funk and Jump, or Jump and Funk.
Jump and Funk, yes.
Which, you know, is devoted to Afrobeat and Fela Kuti's music.
Yes.
Do people know in New York who Fela Kuti is? How relevant is this music to a younger crowd?
It's extremely relevant. I think it would be very surprising to a great deal of people, especially people in the music and the broadcasting business, how known the music is. And at the same time, of course, you can only imagine how many people have absolutely no idea who an artist like Fela Kuti is. So there's enough of a cultural following, people who are intrigued by the music, between dancers and people who are just culturally active and just interested in African culture, and musicians who keep the legacy moving forward.
And he really goes beyond just music into the whole, you know, the quality of the West African, especially culture and society. I mean, he's been described as a James Brown with a political agenda.
Absolutely.
So what was the message, you know, if you had to summarize it for people who didn't know Fela Kuti's music?
Well, the message is if you're downtrodden and there's a system that you live within that's working against your natural necessary needs, you need to find a means to go get those needs, and you need to protest, and you need to stand up for what it is that you believe in and what's morally right when the system that's supposed to be protecting you is not doing that.
And in Fela Kuti's case, that system was a military government.
Absolutely.
In Nigeria. So that kind of statement could and did get him into a lot of trouble.
Got him a lot of attention.
And he wrote about it often in his music, as in the case of this song by the late Fela Kuti called Zombie.
Unless you tell him to go. Zombie. Zombie not go stop unless you tell him to stop.
Zombie.
Zombie not go turn unless you tell him to turn.
Zombie.
Zombie not go think unless you tell him to think.
Zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Fela Kuti and the song called Zombie. We are speaking with DJ Rich Medina, who does the regular Jump and Funk party here in New York, devoted to Afrobeat and the music of Fela Kuti, among others. And also Paul Heck, who is co-producer of Red Hot and Riot, the album that was produced back in 2002. Also tomorrow night, Paul, the big event at the Brooklyn Academy of Music on World AIDS Day. The idea for the Red Hot and Riot record, that came from Questlove from the Roots, right?
That's right. We were working with him on a track for Red Hot and Indigo, which was a Duke Ellington project. And it was around the time when the Fela reissues were just coming out, about 1999. And sort of apropos of nothing, he tore open a Fela record, put it on the turntable, and said, you know, you guys should do a Fela record and call it Red Hot and Riot. I mean, it was like from that. And then like within an hour, I was on the phone tracking down Fela's publishers and managers trying to make it happen. Sometimes ideas are so obvious that it takes someone else to, you know, just tell you, hey, you should do this.
Right. Now, Fela is gone, but there is a second generation of Kuti people, you know, family.
Yeah.
Femi Kuti, his
Femi
son.
Femi Kuti has been performing for years, and I think he's one of the best live performers in the world. I mean, it's just incredible, the kind of show he puts on.
Does he sort of follow in his father's footsteps politically as well as musically?
Well, I guess, you know, it's a different time. Different time, different politics. He's a different, you know, it's like, I was thinking about that last night about would I want to write the same songs as my father, you know?
Right.
So he, in essence, yes, he does follow in his father's footsteps, but he's a different, you know, different artist.
And he apparently not only approved of the idea of Red Hot and Riot, he's on it.
Without Femi, it wouldn't happen. I mean, Femi was there from the very beginning. He actually got together with D'Angelo in Detroit in the middle of his summer tour, and they talked about what they were going to do at the end of the summer, and that resulted in the track that we're hearing now, Water No Good Enemy.
This is from the album Red Hot and Riot, a new take on the music of Fela Kuti.
Bandagba omi lo ma lo.
If your child they grow, now what do you know?
To mi ba pomo re ho, omi no lo ma lo. You don't want that now.
If your child they grow, now what do you know? You don't want
that. O song to le she ko ma lo mi o ra 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 ra.
The song is Water No Water Get No Enemy. I think I got that right. Water No Get Enemy. Paul Heck co-produced this record, Red Hot and Riot, with Fela Kuti's son, Femi Kuti, and also the singer D'Angelo and Macy Gray and a whole bunch of other people. Paul here with us on Soundcheck, as is Rich Medina, the producer and DJ who does this regular party here in New York that features a lot of the music of Fela Kuti. And Rich, we talked a little bit about, you know, both the music and the politics. I mean, I guess in Fela Kuti's own family, he grew up with that mixture, right? His father was a pastor. His mother was like, a feminist. And
definitely. The Fela's music brought a lot of energy to the youth in Nigeria, brought a lot of protest energy to the youth in Nigeria. And his position, because of his family name, he was already in a relatively focal place. And then going to England and going to school and then going to America and becoming influenced by what he was influenced by there. And bringing all that power music, that power perspective back to Nigeria and saying, hey, it's okay for me to make this music and to speak my mind.
So he was listening to American soul and R&B, but he also was aware of the Black Power movement in the 60s.
Well, I think he was listening to a great deal of things. He was a very worldly man when it came to his musical perspectives and his worldview for that matter. But it was when he got to America and he literally saw the Black Power movement was really, I think that really raised the stakes in his perspective and what he wanted to present overall in his music.
Now, there is a song called Coffin No Head of State.
Coffin for the Head of State.
Coffin for the Head of State, which is a musical response to one of the more notorious episodes of interaction between his family and the government. Tell us briefly the story here.
Well, I'll paraphrase as best I can, but Fela was always under some type of investigative procedure through the military police. They found any reason they could to harass him at a particular time. And in this particular instance, the Kalakuta compound was raided. And
this
mother,
is the compound where he lived with his family.
And his mother was thrown from a window and ended up passing away because of her injuries. Mm-hmm. And the record Coffin for Head of State was a dedication to that scenario and just putting those feelings out there on paper and saying...
And then didn't Fela Kuti send his mother's coffin to the governor's mansion, as a form of protest? This is the song, Fela Kuti and Coffin for Head of State.
Waka waka waka,
don't pick up on your knees.
Waka waka waka,
hey, waka waka waka,
waka waka waka,
you go wabalende.
Waka waka waka,
you go down them barracks.
Waka waka waka,
we reach them gate you.
Waka waka waka,
we put the coffin down.
Waka waka waka,
Papa Sanjo dey there.
Waka waka waka,
with a big fat stomach.
Waka waka waka,
gotta do what I did there.
Waka waka waka,
with the neck like ostrich.
Waka waka waka,
we put the coffin down.
Waka, waka, waka.
There no one to take out.
Oh,
there no one to take out.
Oh,
who go one take a coffin?
Oh,
there must take out.
The song is Coffin for Head of State from Fela Kuti, and we're speaking with Paul Heck, who is, among other things, one of the co-producers of tomorrow's big event at BAM, celebrating the music of Fela Kuti on World AIDS Day. Fela Kuti passed away from complications of AIDS back in the late 90s. We're also speaking with Rich Medina, the producer and DJ who runs Jumpin' Funk here in New York. And Rich, before we leave, that last piece, we joined that song about 8 minutes in.
Right.
And it goes on like right. that for a good line. I mean, Fela Kuti's pieces were long form, kind of trance inducing things that it was just like this steady groove, and it just kind of pounded its way into your brain.
Sure.
Did he know what he was doing in terms of getting, I mean, was that conscious to get like the message kind of subliminally?
I think it was very conscious. Yeah. I mean, you know, now with the performances and DJ events where people are playing the music, you know, it's interesting to go to different events and see how long people actually interpret the tunes, because the arrangements is actually musically what makes them so powerful. I mean, the bass line usually doesn't change much, and the rhythm guitar usually doesn't change much, but the vocal arrangements and the way that the emotions climax in the tune through the dialogue is really a lot of the power of what Fela's music was. It, you know, these long, elaborate arrangements that in the end all close with a point of stand up for yourself, or stand up for those that you care about, or the things that you believe in.
Right. Paul Heck, you traveled to Nigeria when you were making the record Red Hot and Riot.
After the first set of recordings with Femi's participation, he invited us to come to Lagos, Nigeria for the reopening of his family's club, the African Shrine.
Right. Now, I mentioned that Fela Kuti, died complications of AIDS. But in Nigeria, it seems like that, at least back in the day when you were there, that was something that was simply not acknowledged.
Despite the Kuti's family's best efforts to be very, very clear-spoken about the fact that Fela had died from AIDS-related causes, there was still a great amount of denial and disbelief, almost, that someone so great and so powerful could be brought down by what people still thought was a conspiracy or a hoax or something. And it was, we inadvertently almost started a riot outside the shrine with people like not believing what we were just saying.
Right. But tomorrow, World AIDS Day, is the day that was chosen for this Fela Kuti event at BAM. I don't want to canonize the guy, though. I mean, he was a great musician, and he certainly stood up for people's rights, but his treatment of women was, you know, at times almost medieval. You know, he seems to have, they were objectified at times on stage during performance. He had many wives, his compound, multiple sex partners and stuff. I mean, this AIDS didn't just kind of like fall from the sky,
Well, he was like most great artists, with complicated, contradictory, man. And, but also in regard to women and the often told story of marrying his 27 singers and dancers, all that stuff he did was a reaction to what, like Rich alluded to, was of the power structure. In Africa, if you're a great, powerful man, you can have as many wives as you can afford. And so in a way, Fela was satirizing that, saying, well, I'm a great and powerful man. And you know, his dancers were harassed because they were considered to be prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was his way of legitimizing them and them working with him.
What about there's a concert tape of him singing about, you know, not using condoms, which, you know, especially in light of what eventually happened to him, seems not just provocative, but downright stupid.
Well, like I said, complex, contradictory man. And we all, every human being has their, you know, blind spots, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What do you think he would make of, you know, using his name, his music on World AIDS Day?
I think he would say some things that I probably can't say in the air, but in a good way. You know, I would hope that he would approve, and that had he been able to get over his illness and live to get through it, because he was always trying to teach and preach people on the side of the righteous, and I think I would hope that he would have seen what the disease was doing to his country and mm-hmm. to the continent.
Yeah, and I mean, as you say, the family seems to certainly support the idea of using Fela Kuti's name to just, if nothing else, increase awareness of what is still a major plague in the subcontinent, sub-Saharan Africa. Let me come back to Rich Medina. It seems like both you, Rich, and Paul have said elsewhere that you discovered Fela Kuti's music essentially the same way, you know, digging through crates and record stores. I mean, it's sure. the way most of us who discovered his music discovered sure. it in the first place. Are people still doing that? Is there still, I mean, there are reissues of his stuff out. It seems like there is some awareness of his music. Why do you think this is happening now?
I think that some of it is a natural evolution of the digging process, for lack of a better way to put it. I mean, DJs and musicians worldwide go through cycles of being attracted to particular genres or particular artists or particular types of music that come from particular places. And, you know, in one instance, this is just another cycle of that, which is very natural. On the other hand, I think that there's a great deal of people who are really looking for inspiration in music. And when they look to a lot of the new things that are within their circumference, they don't find that inspiration. And then when they find something that's truly earthy and truly has to do with people who don't have looking to get what they need, I think that everybody is inspired like by that. I think wealthy people were inspired by the civil rights movement. I think mm-hmm. that there are people who've never been to America who are intrigued by the Native American situation.
Right.
Things, people who've never been to Africa that are intrigued by African things.
So it's not just the relentless groove and the, you know, a neat bass line that a DJ could sample and hold and use. There's the extra musical association as well.
I think that all of that comes into play once you get the music. Once you get it and you're actually able to absorb it into your system, and then yeah. you begin to understand, like, wow, this is even deeper than I expected.
Well, the Jumpin' Funk Party is like a regular occurrence. Here in New York, and DJ and producer Rich Medina has been one of our guests on Soundcheck. Paul Heck is the co-producer of the record Red Hot and Riot, and of tomorrow night's event at the Brooklyn Academy of Music on World AIDS Day. Gentlemen, to the two of you, thanks very much for being with us this afternoon on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, music education. Can it actually make a difference in creating a new audience for classical music? And then later, music that arose from the World War II ghetto of Lodz. Stay with us for Soundcheck.
Muslims go, they call Allahu Akbar. Suffer, suffer for world. Enjoy for heaven. Christians go, they yab. In spiritum heavy news. Muslims go, they call Allahu Akbar. Open your eye everywhere.
Welcome to Musical Storyland. In just a moment, we are to hear a musical story concert by the music maestro. He's going to tell us about all kinds of music. Music that leaps, music that soars, music that whispers, and music that roars. So now sit back in your chair and close your eyes if you want to, because this is a listening hall, and it's sharp ears that count. Yes, the harder you listen, the more you'll hear.
Thank you.
A little blast from our radio past. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Still to come on the program today, music of hope from survivors of the Holocaust. And before we get too far from our Fela Kuti segment, let me just remind you that information, details about Jumpin' Funk, the party, and Red Hot and Riot are on the Soundcheck page of our website, WNYC.org. Right now, though, you can call it No Music Left Behind. Two giants of the classical music world, Carnegie Hall and the Juilliard School, have joined forces to create a program to bring elite musicians into New York public schools. Will it work? We turn first to Drew McManus, orchestra consultant and a blogger on artsjournal.com. Drew, the idea is that these fellows, not necessarily men and not even necessarily from the Juilliard School, will get high-level training, they'll perform at Carnegie Hall, and they'll get guidance from teachers on how to teach music in the public schools. How is this idea different from any number of other music education initiatives that we've seen?
Hi, John. I think it's a little bit different from the standpoint that you have two what you called music giants. Carnegie and Juilliard have gotten together with the New York public school system to put this together to promote both of the organizations and try to create a greater sense of cultural awareness, I think.
So in your view, is the goal to, you know, really do something for the survival of these two institutions, Carnegie Hall and Juilliard, as well as creating more well-rounded musicians?
I'm sure that has a part of it. I think that the two organizations were also interested in creating some partnerships just to strengthen their relationship with each other, and this seems to be one of the first educational forays in that direction.
Right. I also noted several months ago that when Ara Guzulemian, longtime programmer at Carnegie Hall, left Carnegie Hall, he left to take over at the Juilliard School, so perhaps
right.
Not too surprising that this initiative followed. It starts in January with 16 musicians who are part of this kind of fellowship. The goal, though, by the third year is to have 50 fellows, each of them getting a $24,000 annual stipend, health benefits, and practice space, which sounds like a pretty good deal for emerging musicians. But what kind of impact can that have on a massive school system like we have here in New York?
Well, that's pretty tough to say. I think it's a little unclear at this point also exactly what the fellows are going to be doing, because it hasn't really been decided whether they're going to focus more towards general music education or instrumental instruction. And I think one over the other will definitely have probably more impact on individual children's lives.
Right. And certainly, you know, that really colors the whole program, doesn't it? I mean, if you're doing general music education, that's for everybody. If you're doing instrumental performance, well, that's going to be for, you know, a kind of self-selecting, very targeted group of students.
Right, and I don't think there's probably any one universal answer that one solution will be better at one school than another. I always tend to favor the latter, though, of being able to offer individual students the opportunity to create some kind of artistic venue or learn something about themselves or give them an option in life that they may not have had before. I hope they move in that direction.
Well, that actually is a cue for me to bring into the conversation Thomas Wolfe, who is author of the Magic of Music Initiative, a 10-year research project funded by the Knight Foundation that looked at how successful orchestras were, or were not, when they were reaching out to new audiences. Thomas, first of all, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
What works in terms, I mean, after 10 years, you know, given the choice between a sort of broadband, you know, general music education aimed at everybody, or something, as Drew was just talking about, something very targeted to a smaller number of kids, but actually getting them to play an instrument or sing in a chorus, which of those works?
Well, I think it really depends on what outcomes you're looking for. If you're looking to produce high-level instrumentalists that are going to go on to Juilliard, obviously you need a very targeted program for the most gifted students. If you're trying to simply make people aware of music, a general music course is obviously the way to go. But I think the most interesting thing from the work that we did and the work that was done by Audience Insights, which conducted a survey of people across the country, over 25,000 people, and also surveyed orchestra audiences, was the finding that about three-quarters of the people that buy tickets to orchestra concerts today at one time either sang in a choir or played an instrument. And if we are as concerned as I think we should be about the next generation of our audiences for classical music, I'm hoping that whatever they do, it involves some kind of sustained participatory music where kids actually learn to make music, and that it's sustained over time so they get the experience. I'll just add that one of the things we have in this country is a system of youth soccer and Little League, mm-hmm. and one of the reasons why we have so many kids that grow up to be sports fanatics is they understand the game. It would be great to have kids grow up out of the public school systems understanding the game of classical music.
Right. Now, that goes back to something else that was in the Magic of Music initiative, which looked at 15 orchestras over 10 years. And in the report, it states that these orchestras, many of them operate in a, quote, fog of assumptions, unquote, about their audience behavior. The main one perhaps being that simply by exposing youngsters to concert programs, that this will develop the next generation of concert ticket buyers. It sounds like, from what your research has shown, that that's not enough, that you really need the participatory aspect of it. And so to come back again to Drew McManus, I mean, it seemed like you were kind of hoping they'd be able to somehow do both. But if you had to pick one, do you think you would come down to the participatory part?
Oh, sure. I think that's going to end up creating exactly what Tom had mentioned of a greater number of individuals who have a better understanding of what music is about, whether they decide to go into having an interest in classical music or anything else. You know, the whole iPod movement now is creating a certainly large enough awareness of music in general. I would like to see schools move more towards that individual participatory program.
Right. There is a sort of participatory program in the New York school system right now, and that is the Young People's Chorus, which is led here in New York by Francisco Nunez, and a portion of which is in residence here at WNYC. And these are kids who are learning to sing music from the inside, and some of them have gone on to become professional musicians. One's even a composer. But they all grow up, and by the time they get out of school, have a real love and appreciation of music. Here's the YPC in action. That's actually the YPC collaborating with Rufus Wainwright. So, you know, here's like a group of kids, and it is a very targeted group, but they're getting to play music. They're getting to play music with some really terrific professionals. That was recorded here in our Soundcheck studio. We are speaking about a new music education initiative that features Carnegie Hall and the Juilliard School in the New York public school system with Thomas Wolfe, author of the Magic of Music Initiative Report. He's also the CEO of the arts consulting firm Wolfe, Keynes & Company, and Drew McManus, orchestra consultant and a frequent blogger on artsjournal.com and contributor to Soundcheck. Gentlemen, I mentioned the connection, Ara Guzulemian leaving Carnegie Hall, going to the Juilliard School. The good folks at the Juilliard School point out that there is an even longer connection, an even more distant one in history, which is that Frank Damrosch, who founded Juilliard in 1905, was not only a member of the musical family that helped get Carnegie Hall going, but he had also been head of music in the New York City public schools prior to founding Juilliard. So the public schools, Juilliard, Carnegie, you know, it's it was all in the family literally 100 years ago, and trying to be so again now. Tom, the Juilliard-Carnegie plan requires the school system to pay $200,000. The total cost for the program is said to be $5 million a year, with Carnegie and Juilliard raising the rest. Is that a good investment?
Oh, I think it's a good investment. I want to go back, though, to something that you mentioned about the connection between Juilliard and the public schools 100 years ago. You know, one of the things that we need to be very conscious of is that the culture that we're living in today is a very different culture. We had between 1920 and 1980 a tremendous burgeoning of classical music in this country, which I think people misread as the growth of indigenous interest in the field of classical music. Actually, what really happened was that there were three cataclysmic events in Europe, the Russian Revolution, the First World War, and the Second World War, and that brought tremendous numbers of Europeans here, both players, but more importantly, audiences that, as they became more affluent in America, became the ticket buyers that built those classical music institutions.
Mm.
The shift recently, of course, is away from immigration from Europe and more toward immigration from the South, with a different kind of cultural awareness. And so what we have today is a new generation which has not grown up with classical music being very much a part of their culture. And so there's a much less demand on the part of audiences, and there's much less concern on the part of schools. So anything that the cultural institutions can do to work with the schools to provide this is very, very important.
Is there, but that sort of implies that there's a musical hierarchy in that learning Western classical music, the European tradition, is, you know, perhaps better for you than, you know, if we're talking about a huge population from Latin America coming into the school system, maybe the way to get in there, you know, to get people interested in music is through traditional forms of music that they might be able to take some ownership of themselves.
Well, I think that the trend that you're seeing among most musical organizations today, even the major symphonies, is a much more worldly view of what should be incorporated. However, I think if we don't want classical music in the more narrow sense to be completely lost, we need to take some responsibility for making sure that those traditions are passed on.
All right. Drew?
Yeah, John, I was going to just jump in there at that one point, because not too long ago I spent some time down in Venezuela with the amazing classical music culture that exists in Caracas. And one of the things that I had noticed was these children were being taught with very traditional Western classical music approaches, but yet they were absorbing all of the natural music that was in their culture and combining that with those traditional Western European ideas. And I think that just goes to show, in the end, regardless of how music had grown from one direction to another, it's still flexible. It's a cultural language that goes beyond individual ideas or even an evolution of one society over another, and it can combine into something greater. It just needs to have that kind of attention.
As it has in Venezuela, where it's not just a great system of choruses and youth orchestras and stuff, but a terrific woman whose name eludes me at the moment, who is sort of driving that whole thing. And that, you know, it really comes down to the people who are involved, and it remains to be seen who will be involved and to what extent from Carnegie Hall and the Juilliard School in this new initiative. Just announced, it will be starting with 16 fellows. The goal for year three is 50 fellows in the schools, actively engaging the kids in the New York public school system. We've been speaking with Thomas Wolfe, author of the Magic of Music Initiative Report, and Drew McManus, blogger at artsjournal.com. Gentlemen, thank you both for chiming in and joining us on Soundcheck this afternoon.
Thank you. As always, it's a pleasure. Thanks, John.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. You can email us with your thoughts, soundcheck@wnyc.org. In a moment, a new take on some old Jewish music from the ghettos of Lodz, Poland. Brave Old World, next on Soundcheck. Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Each day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. Thanks.